Welcome to Wednesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, classical precision meets rock and roll fire. Performing as Gladius, we'll meet guitarist Andrew Connors, who's playing at libraries in the area. Plus Kratom in North Dakota, the risks of regulation and a ban. Plus a taste of Paris in downtown Bismarck. Prairie Plates visits Brick Oven Bakery with owner Sandy Jacobson. But let's begin Main Street today as millions of birds are making their journey south and North Dakota comes alive with the sights and sounds of fall bird migration. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and each fall, millions of birds move through the Great Plains, some departing after nesting here, others arriving from farther north and using North Dakota as an important place to rest and refuel. We may spot them gathering on wetlands, crossing the evening sky, or even visiting our backyards, but migration is also something we can hear. The calls of cranes overhead, waterfowl on the move, and smaller birds communicating as they travel. Kelly Tevin is a senior coordinator for outreach with Audubon Great Plains, which works across North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska to protect birds and the places they need. She joins us here on Main Street with the voices coming up soon of several migrating birds. She'll help us understand what's happening above us and around us this fall. Kelly, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks so much for coming, Craig.
Just a pleasure to be here. I had a chance to meet you at Trollwood Park a few weeks ago with a fantastic owl demonstration.
So I think that night we had about 12 that we played. Some of those are really rare visitors to our area, depending on what the weather is doing that year or their food sources in Canada. But North Dakota has a really interesting cross-section of owls we might see. So I think that gets a lot of owlers pretty excited season to season.
Was surprising to me. I've heard some of what you played. Haven't necessarily seen them, but I know that I've heard them. So maybe we'll hear more this fall. But before we get into listening for birds, where did your interest for birds come into play, Kelly? Tell us about yourself and your interest in the natural world.
I grew up in a family that did a lot of fishing. Pretty much any vacation that we did as a child was fishing related. And when you're a kid in a boat, of course, these are pre-iPad times, and there's no way my parents were letting me bring a library book in the boat. Eventually your interest turns from looking at the water to looking at the sky. And so looking in trees, spotting birds, just really taking in all the nature that surrounded me. And all of that time. And I grew up in a beautiful area of Minnesota near the St. Croix River, which is just lush. And the opportunity to see many different species and hear their calls and trying to identify them by ear was always something that was kind of a pastime in our family. So I would say that really kickstarted my interest in nature generally and particularly birds.
We're going to use the Merlin app here in a little bit, but my goodness, you had to listen to these birds before the Merlin app existed and try to identify them. How did you work through that as a kid?
I think it was a lot of repetition and mimicking and mirroring some of the same things that we did, you know, with the owl prowl or that I do with youngsters when we're working together and talking about a bird. You know, it's fun to try to make the bird noises. We had our camp out at Spiritwood at Audubon's Edward Brigham Sanctuary there, a 2,300-acre sanctuary for wildlife this summer. And we took the kids on an owl prowl, and we stopped for each owl. We played the sound. The kids got to try to mimic the sound. And I think people are generally really surprised that the variety of noises that owls make. Not every owl makes this, you know, kind of quintessential hoo-hoo noise that we think of when we think of an owl. And so I think we can learn a lot about the different species by the type of sounds that they make too. And it's a good entryway to get people excited and interested in those birds as well.
Your work as the senior outreach coordinator, what's that involve and where do you go in North Dakota?
So I have a lot of latitude in my position, for which I'm very grateful, to respond to requests for outreach if there are classrooms or homeschool cooperatives or colleges or our Audubon chapters, which are like a club, that are looking for some enrichment or information or resources about specific topics, whether it's providing those resources or whether it's actually going to the location. This last weekend, we were down at the first ever Prairie Fest led by the South Dakota Grasslands Coalition at Gooder State Park in South Dakota. And that was a wonderful opportunity of partners coming together to celebrate our grasslands, to interact with communities and teach them about the importance of that biome. So getting to do that work is really wonderful. And also getting to share the amazing things my colleagues are doing with the public and doing that community building aspect. They're out there sometimes doing the hard work in habitat restoration, scientific research, and I get to share what Audubon is doing and involved in. And it's a really great privilege to be able to do that.
You mentioned South Dakota. I mentioned earlier you also serve Nebraska. What connects those three states, our three states, I guess, from a bird conservation perspective?
So Audubon has broken up our country into different regions. Some of those regions coincide with a flyway or unique habitat needs that birds have that we can then work together and leverage our resources more effectively. The thing that connects North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska is the grasslands. A lot of people don't realize that grasslands are one of our most imperiled biomes, not just in North America, but worldwide, because of how easily they're converted to croplands and to housing developments. They're kind of alluring to developers in a variety of ways, and the soil is also very rich in a lot of them. So it's an area that we're trying to protect, and our grassland bird species have seen more of a decline than many other bird group species, up to about 70% of a decline in grassland birds over the last 100 years, based on counting and research. So it's definitely an area of improvement that we would love to see, bending the bird curve, as we say in Audubon, and bringing those species back by helping to restore this really essential habitat.
Are people sometimes surprised that Audubon is here and working hard in North Dakota?
Sure. We do have some, you know, interesting confusion, being that there's a town called Audubon, and then there is also a Lake Audubon in North Dakota. So when I say I work for Audubon, sometimes there is confusion. But I think for bird lovers, Audubon is synonymous with bird science, bird research, the protection of birds. So bringing in the community and educating them about what we're doing. In North and South Dakota, we don't have any Audubon centers. Whereas we do have two in Nebraska. We have Spring Creek Prairie, and we also have Roe. And those are two really unique centers that invite the public in, that have, you know, accessibility options. At Roe, you can view the sandhill cranes, which I've been fortunate enough to go down and assist with, and it's a spectacular experience. And we don't necessarily have those kind of facilities here in North and South Dakota, but we're really focused on rehabilitating habitats that will help our birds and our wildlife in general. And also, we like to say too, working with landowners, what's good for the bird is good for the herd. So working with producers, working with ranchers, and trying to help them make sure that if they're interested in reestablishing native habitat and prairie and supporting wildlife, that we can assist them in doing that.
Enjoying my conversation with Kelly Tevin. She's a senior outreach coordinator for Great Plains Audubon. And we're going to now talk about fall bird migration. Set the scene for us, Kelly. What's happening or about to happen over the skies of North Dakota as fall bird migration gets underway?
Migration is one of those wonders of nature. And we're still learning a lot about how birds migrate, when they do it. And with the advent of satellite technology that's able to show us a bird cast, kind of like a weather forecast, but for bird migration, we're learning so much about when birds are migrating, at what altitudes they're doing it, what times of the evening. And there are so many species. And part of the reason migration has been a mystery for so long is that most birds migrate at night. And because of that fact, obviously our human eyes are not attuned to being able to see that, especially at high levels.
Are they using stars to migrate?
So different birds have different tactics. Some have multiple. So some birds are using the night sky. Some birds are using the magnetic field. Some birds, we're still not 100% sure how they're figuring it out. But it is really an amazing feat of nature that these migrations are happening every year. Some of our birds that we have here in North Dakota that are summering here are going as far south as the very southern tip of Chile and making these incredible journeys every year round trip.
When I think of fall migration, I think of one big southward march, so to speak, that's never ending almost. But it really is different species at different times in different places.
Absolutely. And there are some species, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that North Dakota is where they winter. We're their Florida, so to speak.
Hard to believe, but
it
okay.
Really is. People who love to see in our area the friendly little dark-eyed juncos coming and staying the winter at their feeders, this is where they come for the winter. And otherwise, they're up in Canada, way in those northern climes for the summer. So it just really depends on what the bird species needs and, what their food sources are, where they're headed, and when.
Do we know enough scientifically about what tells a bird, it's time to go wherever that place that I want to go is?
So we do have, with some species, there's been more research than others. And so some indications are alluding to the fact that the changing sunlight during the day, the lessening of sunlight hours as the season goes on, some more related to food scarcity, changes in temperature. So there is still lots of ongoing research in that area, like for many animals, like what changes an Arctic fox's, coat, like how do they know, when is it happening, or monarch migration. So there's this wonderful ongoing research that we're learning more and more all the time about why these animals are doing what they do, and then how some of our changes to the environment might be impacting them in the long run.
North Dakota lies within the Central Flyway. What does that mean, and why is this region so important to migrating birds?
So here in Fargo, particularly in North Dakota Greater, we are at the convergence of two flyways. So it's really exciting. And along the flyway, the Central Flyway that we are primarily a part of, is like a waterfowl superhighway. North Dakota is sometimes called the duck factory of North America due to our prairie pothole region. We have more breeding ducks and waterfowl than a lot of people can imagine, in the millions. And we are very fortunate to have that habitat, that we get to see some really amazing waterfowl. But part of that also means that we have lots of birds that are depending on our habitat to be here as stopover sites on their way, whether they're coming from Alaska or, northern Canada, and they're headed all the way down to Central or South America to find similar habitat for the winter season too.
Is fall migration different in your eyes than spring migration relative to pace or routes or behaviors of birds that are going one way or the other?
So I have heard it described by one of our local ornithologists particularly, that spring migration is like turning on your water faucet full blast, and fall migration is like more of a trickle. You just don't necessarily have that hurried impetus all the time as much for fall migration, because they're usually coming up here to breed. So they're on a time schedule sometimes for our birds in the spring. Whereas in the fall, it can be a little bit different just depending on the species and how the season has been in terms of their habitat.
Kelly, our time today is limited, so we're going to bring you back tomorrow, and we're going to listen to some of the birds that we're going to get to hear as fall migration begins. Kelly Devin is a senior outreach coordinator for Audubon Great Plains. And Kelly, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Craig.
Social Security is a source of retirement income for many individuals. During the election season, AARP North Dakota provides information about Social Security and issues affecting older Americans. Learn more at aarp.org/social-security.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Classical precision, flamenco fire, and the raw energy of rock rarely meet in the hands of one guitarist, but that is the musical territory Andrew Connors has made his own. Performing under the name Gladius, the Atlanta musician began playing at the age of 10 on an old Argentine classical guitar he later studied with the late John Sutherland, was a student of Andrés Segovia, while also drawing inspiration from rock virtuosos, including Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhoads. His path nearly ended when nerve damage affected both wrists and both elbows, leading to 4 surgeries and years of physical therapy. Instead, rebuilt his ability to play and transformed that experience into music. He'll be playing at Detroit Lakes Public Library today at 6 p.m., tomorrow, Thursday, at the Holly Public Library, that's at 1:30 p.m., and at the Moorhead Public Library at 7 p.m. tomorrow. Andrew Connors, Gladius, joins us to share his remarkable story. Welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you, Craig. I'm glad to be here.
You are in the area. You're performing at libraries. Why do you perform at libraries?
Well, you know, I mean, I figured, who wouldn't want to perform at libraries? I mean, it's like every kid's dream for a job, right? I mean, you literally get paid to make noise in the library. Like, what could be cooler than that? Huh? That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So your first instrument was an old Argentine classical guitar given to you by your uncle?
Yeah.
What do you remember about holding that thing and trying to play it?
I just remember the strings being about a half a foot off the fretboard and just trying to squeeze the living daylights out of them. that's what I remember. But it wasn't the most playable guitar, but it was enough to get me started.
If I go listen to you play here either today or tomorrow, what am I going to hear? What kind of music does Gladius present?
You know, I hate to spoil the element of surprise now. So just to whet your appetite, you would likely hear a blend of influences ranging anywhere from classical to heavy rock to, of course, flamenco and a whole range of things along the way. So it's definitely a fusion. But depending on who you ask, it's like, do you play anything besides flamenco? And then the next person in line might say, well, do you play any flamenco?
So, where did the word Gladius come from for you? It's a Latin word for sword. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Gladius is Latin for sword, but it's not the, historically it was the Roman short sword, but it's not that sword that I'm referring to. It's actually a scriptural reference to Ephesians and the full armor of God, as the Apostle Paul wrote about in Ephesians 6. So the sword of the Spirit being the Word of God.
You have roots in the American South. Tell me how that influenced what I hear when you play.
Good question. Maybe it's all that heat that just fans the flames, so to speak. But then again, I am touring up north and doing my best to give the deep Southeast a wide berth most of the summer, so there is that.
As I said in my open, Gladius, you had nerve injuries to both wrists and elbows, nerve damage. How has that impacted your music? Is it any different before than it is now?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not really think about that too often, but I would say, yeah, it's definitely changed the way that I approach the instrument, the practice, the maintenance. There's more of an athletic component to it, you know, physical fitness. Now it's not just like I play my guitar, but it's also you could say, I mean, yes, music is therapeutical, but even like physically therapeutical as far as the fingers go, as far as I'm concerned. So I would say that's the main difference, but that definitely, I'm sure it impacts the way that I play and the way that I compose, you know, even so far as composing pieces that are not only soothing to the ear, but also soothing to the fingers.
As you're playing in libraries and you're looking out at the audience, generally, is your audience a little older than perhaps if you were playing at a different venue?
So you really get a mix. Library gigs are an interesting lot. You know, I do youth programs as well, so sometimes I'll get super young audiences. Sometimes they're a bit on the older side, so it just depends also what kind of program it is, as well as what time of day, what time and what day of the week it might be. So another thing I've learned, this is true not just of libraries, I suppose any venue in general, but you got to be ready to play with equal enthusiasm, whether 200 people or two people show up. And I've certainly seen both extreme ends of the spectrum.
Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me online at gladiusofficial.com. That's G-L-A-D-I-U-S official.com. You can find me on your favorite platforms from there, the YouTube, the Spotify, the Facebook, and all that good stuff. And I keep a mailing list for those who like to stay in the loop.
Andrew Connors performs and records under the name Gladius. You can listen to him at the Detroit Lakes Public Library tonight. That's at 6 p.m. or tomorrow at the Holly Public Library at 1:30 p.m. or the Moorhead Public Library also on Thursday. That's at 7 p.m. Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Still to come on this Wednesday's Main Street, as North Dakota lawmakers in special session consider how to regulate kratom, Prairie Beat examines the opioid-like compounds sold in concentrated products such as 7-OH, plus a taste of Paris in downtown Fargo. Prairie Plates visits the Brick Oven Bakery. We're glad that you are with us today. That's all ahead, right after this news. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. North Dakota lawmakers are considering how to address kratom, a largely unregulated substance sold in some convenience stores and marketed as a supplement. Today, Prairie Beat explores its risks and the unintended consequences a blanket ban could create.
There are changes made to these parts of the brain, and most of them are unconscious parts of the brain. No one has any control over it. All the parts of the brain that have changes, taken as a whole, like, they contribute to the behavior of this person with addiction.
Well, hey there, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back once again to Prairie Beat,
our weekly news podcast from us here at Prairie Public. So, Danielle, what is on the beat this week?
Well, the North Dakota legislature gavels in today. We've been talking about this for a bit here. Governor Kelly Armstrong called this special session to address an unregulated substance sold as a supplement called kratom. And this is really something that seemed to kind of burst onto the scene from, you know, out of seemingly nowhere. But it really has been under our noses for a while. And a lot of people, I think, especially young people, do have a better understanding of what kratom is. I was able to speak to someone about kratom and what a potential ban on the substance might mean for the region.
Yeah, kratom, you know, I do confess maybe this is my age bracket, but it's something that I didn't really know much about until I heard the governor said he wanted to get rid of it. And I still feel like I have a lot more questions than answers about it myself. So let's get into it.
Alrighty.
Robert Cole Perringer, MD. I'm an addiction medicine specialist and toxicologist.
Dr. Perringer is with Essentia Health, and they have a substance use and addiction care program there where he is medical director. And when we talked, he explained that kratom essentially is a leaf. It's from Southeast Asia. It's been used for hundreds of years, and it has properties that are effective to treat things like pain and anxiety. But he says it also has hundreds of other properties, including a compound called metragenine. This amounts to an opioid, and that when concentrated, it can cause heavy substance use disorder and difficult withdrawal. So that concentrated compound has been bottled and sold as a supplement in gas stations all over the place. A lot of people know it by its name, 7-OH.
When something is sold as a supplement in the United States, there is no regulation. No one is overseeing whether the dose they're giving is correct, whether what they're actually giving is correct. Selling something as a supplement, there comes with no regulation.
Now, part of the topic I do remember, because I'm not entirely opposed to supplements. I mean, you know, vitamins and all. I give my kiddos little Flintstone iron ones every single day. But the supplement industry, it's kind of a thing for me, you know, as far as they don't have anybody really regulating them, overseeing them. They can make any claims they want without any sort of repercussions and advertise. They can promise and guarantee anything. I mean, it really is kind of a wild, wild west out there when it comes to supplements.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, if we look back a little bit, we both remember the opioid crisis, right? Mm-hmm. People developed dependency on these opioids that were pushed to them by doctors in the early 2000s. Regulation reined those in. People searched for cheaper alternatives on the street. They found heroin. That eventually led them to fentanyl a few years ago. I think it's probably like 10, 15 years that's mm-hmm. become a big thing. It's extremely potent and deadly. Dr. Perringer says once someone is introduced to fentanyl, it's kind of like a 50-50% chance that they're dead within a year or two.
Wow.
That's how dangerous it is, and that's how simple it can be to overdose. Now, kratom and the 7-OH that we've been talking about, it does contain that opioid-like property in it. People who use it are highly susceptible to developing a use disorder with it, and the withdrawal symptoms are really terrible. Perringer described it as life-ruining, actually. But he says people don't really overdose on it. And while he says the dependency on 7-OH definitely creates a lot of problems for people, he thinks the blanket banning of all kratom could lead to overdose deaths when people start searching for alternatives on the street.
I think there needs to be, especially with 7-hydroxy and the potent derivatives or breakdown products, there needs to be regulation. The concern is that if you just create regulation or take away something, what ends up happening is people turn to something else. And the concern is that they'll turn to the street opioids, and anything you get off the street is fentanyl. And we know that if any drug seizure happens, a drug bust, you take an area about a mile around that radius, and there's an increase in overdoses all around that radius because they turn to a different supplier.
Okay, that's interesting, because I remember Governor Armstrong saying that upwards of a couple dozen people in North Dakota had died, and those deaths were related to kratom. Now, it sounds like the 7-OH dependencies could be contributing to deadly behaviors with street drugs like fentanyl. That said, I think I agree with Dr. Perringer about a blanket ban. Like, I don't want what amounts to opioid supplement drinks for sale at every convenience store in the state for anyone to purchase. But it does sound like there's a lot of nuance here with the original uses, the different properties and compounds when it comes to drugs and synthetic drugs. It's really fascinating how things are discovered and either outlawed or regulated, and then how the drug suppliers are able to figure out a response to that. It's like a game of whack-a-mole, mm-hmm. right? Like, who would ever think that a leaf that treats a little anxiety could lead to something more deadly with somebody buying fentanyl off the street?
It really does sound kind of dramatic, right? And very Dare video. But that's what Dr. Perringer says, you know, that these substances are able to alter the brain enough to create those dependencies and use disorders and develops into an actual disease, which can lead to different behaviors. And as long as we have to navigate these issues with different substances out there, either on the street or in the pharmacy or even gas stations, there are resources available to help people with addiction or use disorder, as Dr. Perringer refers to it, substance use disorder. He says that name change is aimed at reducing the stigma, because when people hear addiction, they might have a negative connotation. So while all that is going on, Perringer says he kind of tends to favor a more phased approach at regulating kratom.
We can give education because we do have a way to treat kratom use disorder or opioid use disorder, and it's called buprenorphine. And it works wonderfully to treat withdrawal, to treat pain, as a safe substitution therapy. Patients need to know this, and providers need to be comfortable with this. And so that's the education that I think is really important that needs to be provided to the public and providers for when kratom regulation does happen.
Dr. Perringer says anyone struggling with any substance use disorder is welcome to contact Essentia. They have a care program that has three different phases, from inpatient and emergency care, a primary care team, and even a bridge care program. And they have a 24/7 substance use disorder hotline you can call as well that can kind of get you started. That is at 833-677-1262.
Yeah, you know what? Pause this podcast and rewind a little bit if you need to jot down that number, a very important phone number again, 833-677-1262. So, Danielle, with lawmakers back in Bismarck, do you have any pulse on what they may do with kratom legislation?
Well, it's probably a fool's errand to try to predict what the legislature will do, but we do know a couple of things. So Governor Armstrong did issue that executive order about a month ago banning kratom, and that's in effect until, you know, whatever the legislature comes up with here. From what I understand, in their pre-session sessions, for lack of a better, you know, way to describe it, they did not approve anything that would amount to a total ban. So what we might see come out of this session is a more nuanced bill. And when I spoke to Dr. Perringer, he did say that Kansas instituted a total ban and that they saw immediate increases in overdoses in the aftermath of that. So this is something lawmakers are kind of learning on the fly as they go. So we'll see what North Dakota comes up with very shortly here.
Once again, the law of unintended consequences happening there in Kansas. Hopefully that doesn't happen here in North Dakota. So in this 3-day session, our lawmakers will be taking up Kratom. Now, I've seen some reporting about funds for the military museum. I know Dave Thompson will be on the beat about that like he always has been. So more to come. What other headlines, Danielle, have we been covering throughout the newsroom this week?
So I think we're going to meet or exceed our revenue projections for the biennium.
Well, apparently budget forecasts were inaccurate, as apparently the state collected more oil tax revenue than originally thought.
It's just so important to remain grounded in the everyday experiences of students and teachers.
State School Superintendent Levi Bachmeyer and other public instruction employees will be joining our teachers this year in the classroom as substitute teachers for a few days each. And Eric, we also need to mention, of course, you know, the last episode of the Great American Folk Show aired over the weekend. Not exactly hard-hitting news, but it's still a pretty big deal. I know you and Tom Brousseau, you did a lot of really great work together on that show over the last several years.
Oh, thank you, Danielle. I am going to miss it. You know, it's like it's a regular routine, and you get the muscle memory of doing the show, producing it every week, and working with Tom, just such a talent. So yeah, I'll definitely miss it. But Tom will be playing music everywhere in North Dakota, I'm sure. We'll cross paths again someday. But yeah, hey, if you listen this weekend, we have a new show debuting in its place called Sports in America with David Green. So even if you don't like sports, I'm looking at you, Danielle.
Check it out.
I think you'll like Sports in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thanks for the nod on that, Danielle.
You bet. And, you know, hey, if you want to hear more news and more great shows, be sure to tune in to Prairie Public and check out our online newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org.
Well, that's it for this week for Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That was Prairie Beat. New episodes drop each Wednesday. Subscribe to it as one of your favorite podcasts. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Welcome to another segment of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Guillen. This week's guest runs a very special place in downtown Bismarck. It's one of my favorite stops when I'm in the Bismarck Mandan area. And her name is Sandy Jacobson, owner of Brick Oven Bakery at 112 North 4th Street in downtown Bismarck. Sandy, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited about this. I'm excited to be here. And I'm so excited that you like the place.
Yeah, like I said, it's one of my favorite stops when I'm in the Bismarck Mandan area, and I see a lot of friends when I go in there. You're a new one, but I always see a lot of people I know, so I know it's a really good place.
That's so funny that you mentioned that, because there are so many times when I'm helping somebody on the front and somebody comes through the drive-thru, and all of a sudden my front person is like yelling at the person in the drive-thru and waving and like, hey, how are you today? So it's like, yeah, it's almost like this meeting spot for everybody. And they don't mean to meet there. They just accidentally happen to meet there. So it's cool.
And that's what happens every time I'm there. And it's just a great, it's just a great experience. Well, Sandy, Brick Oven Bakery offers a lot of items, not only, well, coffee, pastries, breads, but describe Brick Oven Bakery for our listeners.
We're kind of a French patisserie in town. I guess when we first started this, so we're going on 7 years. This coming up month, we're going to be 7 years in this business. So
wow.
When we first started back in the day, we just saw a need for something that just wasn't happening in Bismarck. Sure, I could get a croissant or something at Sam's Club or wherever, but like, there just wasn't anything that was traditionally made. And we just saw like a need in the community, and we were like, let's just go for it. So So we do French patisserie. We do sourdough bread. When we first had this idea, we were like, yeah, I guess we'll serve coffee. We'll just serve black coffee. And then myself, I worked at Starbucks for a really long time and I love good coffee. So I was like, we can't do that. We've got to have some extra specialty coffee. So we bit the bullet and bought the espresso machine and did the things, and I'm so glad we did. And then after a little while, we started adding lunches on, and that's been really good too. People are really enjoying our lunch. So I think the biggest thing for people to take away from coming to our shop is that everything is scratch made. Like, nothing is purchased from a food supplier and then baked. Like, we make everything. We make the dough, we make the cake. Like, everything is from scratch. So I think that's the biggest takeaway.
Well, my favorites are the almond croissant and fresh fruit Danish. And I do like the breakfast croissants, but you're not the baker, but you wear many hats as an owner. Can you talk about your role or roles at Brick Oven Bakery?
So yeah, I'm definitely not the baker. It's funny how many people think that I'm the baker, because I feel like it seems like it would be a woman's position, but like, I can barely cook food for my kids. So like, he definitely does the majority of all of the things. So my role is more, you know, community-based, making sure that we're advertising correctly, making sure that we're hiring the right people that really just enjoy the environment, and hiring people that love to talk to other people. And, you know, I of course do all the payroll and all those like behind the scenes things. Yeah. So that's kind of what I do. I'm just making sure that, you know, we're donating to the good places in town. We're making sure every time we have leftover pastries, we take them to Ministry on the Margins for unhoused people. And, you know, we make sure to like donate things within the community. If there's ever like someone doing a fundraiser, we donate gift cards and things like that. And right now we're actually moving towards wholesale for restaurants. So for instance, Daryl at the Barbecue Pit is using our funds for some of his sandwiches. So that's kind of our next step, is to just kind of get into some restaurants and just allow people to, they serve great food and then they have to buy a frozen bun. And I just would much rather like, hey, we can help you and we can give you at a great price a homemade bun for this. So that's kind of where we're going towards now.
You're spreading the love, so to speak. We're having a great conversation today with Sandy Jacobson, owner of Brick Oven Bakery in downtown Bismarck, one of my favorite spots in North Dakota. And I'm usually there in the mornings for coffee and some pastries. But let's talk about this special Germans from Russia soup that everyone loves.
Right, exactly. It's so funny when people come in and ask for it, because some people know exactly what it is. And then you get the out-of-towners and they're like, can I try that Knefla soup? Because it's spelled weird, you know? So it's kind of funny and having to try and explain it to them. But yes, our Knefla soup is back. We make the dough for the dumplings homemade. We don't buy that, you know, that's all fresh homemade. We make our own mirepoix, which is the carrots and the celery and all the things. And we just do it in really big batches. So we do that in the fall. So September 1st today, we brought in our Knefla is back. And then we kind of revamped our Danish menu. So we're doing a play on our pies. So at Thanksgiving time, we make pies. And the three pies that we make are an apple, a pecan, and a pumpkin. So we are doing a play on that with our Danishes. So we've got a pecan Danish, we've got a pumpkin pie Danish, and we also have an apple crumble Danish, which is so good. I love it. So we've got that. Then, of course, we've got some fall drinks coming at you, just like the pumpkin spice, of course, because that's the classic. But we also did like a caramel apple spice. We have a blueberry pancake latte, which is so good. And my manager, Annika, she is the one who came up with all of these drinks. So kudos to her for that. And then the blueberry pancake latte also matches our new cruffin. And our cruffin this month is blueberry pancake. So that's kind of a fun one.
Your cruffins are quite good. They really are.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's something different. than, you know, your normal pastry. It's the croissant dough, and then we make it in a muffin tin and fill it with pastry cream. Then, of course, it's covered in sugar. And so we do a vanilla gruffin, and then every month we do a specialty. So this month is our blueberry pancake gruffin. So that's going to be a fun one.
And do you also sell cookies?
We do, yeah. So we have three different cookies. Our signature cookie, I would say, is our chocolate walnut, which is kind of funny because I'm a very picky eater, Steve will tell you, and he hates it because he likes everything. But when he made that chocolate walnut cookie, I was like, I don't know. And then I tried it and I was like, okay, I guess I do like walnuts. So we've got that one. That's our signature. And then over time, we've brought on our double chocolate cookie, which is grape. And then he came up with this other cookie called coffee toffee, which has started to catch on now. I'm telling people about it because I love toffee. It's like one of my favorite things. And this cookie has homemade toffee in it. I think that's what's different about us. Like, we don't just like, oh, we want to make a toffee coffee cookie, so let's buy toffee crumble. We make the toffee crumble for the toffee cookie. So it's phenomenal. You definitely have to try it if you come in.
And that passion and hard work really shows in your products. I mean, they not only look good, but they really do taste good. And I'm hungry doing this interview. I'm at our Fargo studio today, and I wish I was closer to the Bismarck studio.
Yeah, you got to do these in person so that you can get some free pastry out at the deal or something.
You know, when I visit Brick Oven Bakery, it's very busy. And we talked about that earlier, running into friends and the drive-through. But why do you think that is? You talked about community. I talked about passion.
Yeah. Yes, the food is important, but I also think it's just the atmosphere in there. It just feels different when you walk into the building. It has a different vibe. It doesn't really feel like you're in classic Bismarck, right? It feels like you just walked into another state or something, or into Paris, honestly. I mean, when we first started this, I mean, we had never been to Paris before. We have since, but that's just what we wanted. We were like, okay, we're making a French pastries. We want it to feel like you're walking off the street and you're coming into somewhere that's just totally different, where you can just forget about your life and you can sit and enjoy time to yourself and feel relaxed. Like, I want people to walk into the store and I just want their shoulders to drop and just their jaws to unclench and them to just sit and relax and see a friend and have a great coffee and have a great pastry and just feel like they don't have to worry about their day-to-day life for a little bit, even if it's 10 minutes.
Another thing that I enjoy about going into Brick Oven Bakery is the art. And tell us about why you like to feature local artists.
This started when about a year ago, we started a production space because we were just running out of space. There was no room for people to sit. And we were like, we need to have more space for people. So we took all our coolers and all our things out of the bakery and we purchased a production space. And then we put in more seating. And I was looking at these walls and I'm looking up all of these things I could put on the walls. And all the art is so expensive. And I'm just like, I don't know what to put on these walls. And then Paul Newt came in. He's kind of a regular and he's a, you know, known person in town. And he probably doesn't even know this, but when I saw him, my brain was like, hello, why don't I feature local artists? It was just something when I saw him just clicked in my head. And I was like, okay, this could be really cool. And so then I kind of started doing some research and I decided I don't want them to have to pay to hang their art. I'm not taking a commission of their art because there's some really talented people in Bismarck and like I want them to get everything they can out of it. So we started out with kids art actually is how it kind of started. And that was our first month we did that and kids would bring in their stuff and they could hang their things and they could, you know, get a little bit of paid for it, which was really cool. And then eventually some more artists came to me and it's been a really cool thing. So we feature a new artist every month. If you are an artist or anybody listening, you can go to our website, which is brickovenbakerynv.com, and you can look up artist showcase. And there's a online form you can fill out that gives you all the descriptions of everything that you would need to know about hanging your art. And then you can kind of choose a month that you'd like, and we can see if it's available, and definitely come in and check that out.
Well, I think it just goes with your community-minded focus. And speaking of the word talent, there's anima cucina, there's fire flower pizza,
yeah.
There's noodle zip.
Yeah.
What's it like
so
to be
great.
A... Yeah, it is. Downtown Bismarck has a great food scene. And
yeah.
What's it like to be part of a vibrant Downtown Bismarck food community?
It's so cool. We've gotten to know a few of the people. We love Noodle Zip. He's a great guy. Really great food. It's just nice to surround yourself with people that care about the food and have a passion for the food and not just running a business. It's so much more than that, especially for Steve. You know, I mean, I'm not the cook, so like I don't feel necessarily that passion for food. But when he talks to me about it, man, he could talk for hours. And we absolutely love the world of macarons. This guy, his wife, makes macarons, and Steve said they're the best macarons he's ever had. He absolutely loves them. They come to Bismarck, so you should check them out on Saturdays. But he met up with him last night for a couple hours because they're going to start doing coffee in their little truck when they go places. And we spent 2.5 hours kind of teaching him how to run the coffee machine because he had just got it. And he had built this coffee trailer, and Steve said it's so good how he built this coffee trailer and looked so awesome. And so it was kind of this like, hey, I'll help you figure out how to run this coffee machine. Like, I kind of know how to do this, so I'm going to help you with that. So he spent a couple hours, and in turn, that person is going to come and maybe help us do a little revamping at our bakery when we're ready to do some revamping, you know? So it's just like this, everybody's helping each other out, and we definitely want that. Like, if anybody is ever interested in starting a business, whether it be the food side, the coffee side, the finance side, the anything, like, reach out to us, because we love helping other people. In 10 years, maybe, when we're not running a bakery, it's something we'd love to do. Like, why not share your knowledge? And I think that that's part of the food community downtown, has just everybody kind of just shares their knowledge. And if you don't know something, somebody knows it, and you can reach out. And if they don't know it, they know somebody who knows it.
It all works together, and I think that's just fantastic. Sandy, where can people find Brick Oven Bakery online? Website, social media?
So we have our brickovenbakerynd.com. There happens to be a Brick Oven Bakery in Minnesota, too. So you want to make sure you're doing the North Dakota one. So brickovenbakerynd.com. We also have our social media, which is our Instagram, which of course is Brick Oven Bakery ND also. So follow along there. It tells you all the breads that we have and just what's going on at the bakery, who our artist is for the month. And so you can find us on those socials there, or you can come down 112 North 4th Street. So you can come through the drive-thru, you can come in and sit for a while and just enjoy the ambiance.
Well, Sandy Jacobson, owner of Brick Oven Bakery in downtown Bismarck, thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Have a great day, and hopefully we'll see you at the bakery soon.
Sounds good. This has been another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Gion. We'll talk to you next week.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. Olivia Rodrigo curated her own all-women music festival.
It was really important for me to do this festival right now, because I just think that the people who want to keep us down are really relying on us feeling alone and overwhelmed. And I think the antidote to that is joy and community.
We talk about that, her latest album, and more on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. Tomorrow on the show, unearthing Bismarck's past near the governor's residence, well, it took an unexpected turn earlier this year when crews uncovered human remains and coffin fragments. North Dakota Monitor reporter Michael Ochterlein explains the site's connection to Bismarck's first cemetery and the effort now to investigate and respectfully exhume the remains. That's on A Closer Look with the Monitor. Plus, Kelly Tevin from Audubon Great Plains returns, and we'll hear the birds to listen for during fall bird migration here in North Dakota. Plus, Dave Thompson will bring us up to the minute with the special session of the North Dakota Legislature. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street here on Prairie Public, and we look forward to your joining us again.